went on a three-day-long strike to protest against the Quebec government's decision to hike the tuition fees by 33% for out-of-province students at English universities and impose new French proficiency requirements. The provincial government said that the change is part of an effort to invest more money in French universities and decrease the number of non-French-speaking students. Students wore red squares as a show of solidarity and a symbol of the previous student strikes in 2012. They marched around campus while carrying large banners, banging pots, and chanting different slogans such as, "The Students United will never be defeated." Organizers of the strike have argued that this decision is putting the entire community at risk as it will limit the accessibility and affordability of higher education and negatively impact the quality of education. Protesters said that they hope their efforts are adding more pressure on the government and encouraging students from other universities to make their voices heard as well. More demonstrations are planned for the future. Quebec's surgery backlog has hit a new record. Katie Brady has more.
Quebec's surgery waitlist has reached 170,000. That's higher than during the pandemic. And experts say with the state of healthcare right now, it's going to be a slow climb out of this. President of the Quebec Association of Surgery, Dr. Patrick Charlebois, told CJLO how we got here and what it will take to reduce the backlog.
We expected a rise in the number of patients that are waiting for surgery. I mean, these are tremendously high numbers that we've been dealing with for a long time now. We had worked hard trying to decrease our number of patients waiting, making deals with the government for a plan de rattrapage, investing $400 million to support manpower in this plan. And that hasn't taken off at all. And then we were affected by the days of strikes that were held at the end of the year. And that had an impact. We don't know the true impact, and we're starting to see it now, I guess. But at the time it was happening, we're expecting 400 to 500 patients a day were being of day of strike, were being surgery was being canceled and delayed. So now we're starting to see the impact of all that, and we're going to have to catch up.
How long do you think it will take to reduce this back down to a less startling number?
It is startling numbers, and these are real people, right? It's 170,000 of our friends and colleagues and family that are at home waiting for surgeries. They're not all life-threatening. The urgent surgeries, the cancer surgeries are being done, but all these other people are still have ailments that require surgery to fix. They're suffering in many cases. So these cases need to get done. We need to get these lists down for our system to be able to take care of the whole chain of production, if you want the image, to get a patient through surgery. We need clinics that are running effectively. We need to see these patients. We need the preoperative clinic that's our staffed, and so the patients can be seen in a timely fashion and prepared adequately for their surgery too, so that things run smoothly in the scheduling afterwards. Nursing in the operating room, nursing in our recovery room, in our inpatients units to be able to take care of these patients.
For the full interview with Dr. Charlebois, tune in to CJLO Thursday at 9 a.m. for our weekly news roundup. In Montreal for CJLO, I'm Katie Brady.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Cadenza Montreal on CJLO 1690. I'm Stephanie Manning. I'll be joined shortly in a few minutes by the early music soprano Ellen Torrey. But before we get to that, we'll just have some music so we can get all set up. Looking forward to speaking with her. So in the sense of before we speak to her, we can get in the mood with some music by Ensemble Mirabilia. This is Belle Duet off their album Amour Fou, featuring Miriam LeBlanc and Ellen Torrey.
Thank you. Oh. Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Brew. Crossover Comics. Sharing your passion since 2012.
Welcome back to CJLO 1690, and this is Cadenza Montreal. I'm joined live by Ellen Torrey, an early music soprano and singer-songwriter living in Montreal. They will be performing as the duo Calliope with tenor and guitarist Carrie Bursey on Saturday, February 10th at Christ Church Cathedral. Their program is called Muse and Mode, and it explores human storytelling from antiquity to the modern day. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I saw Calliope performed Muse and Mode back in 2021 during the Banff Center's Evolution Classical program. How does it feel to revisit it now in 2024?
That's a great question. It was such a different time for artists in 2021 when we conceived this program. Most of all, we couldn't actually perform the program live in person for anybody, which was, you know, different, and it was sad in some ways, but in other ways it really forced us to be creative about how we could present the material in a way that was still engaging, like in a virtual setting. So I'm really looking forward to using all of the elements of that performance and making it a little more intimate and a little more personal now that we have the privilege of a live audience for this performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And have the music selections stayed the same since 2021, or have they also shifted?
They've mostly stayed the same. Actually, my colleague, Carrie, he's on tour doing a different project right now. So most of our preparation has been virtual. We've been working on our own individual projects, which we're both going to try and incorporate into the program. But a lot of the original material is going to stay, because it's really the concept relies on the music that we chose to sort of tell the story and kind of represent a narrative. So a lot of it's going to stay the same, which is nice because we haven't performed this material in Montreal at all yet. So,
all right, great. So yeah, Montreal debut for this right. Program specifically. And so you kind of talked a little bit about the arc of this program, how you put it together. Can you kind of expand a little bit more on that, how it came to be?
Yes, absolutely. I don't want to give away too much, but we definitely, when we were conceiving the program, we were both really personally interested in like the function of musical mode in storytelling. I have a background in music therapy, and some of my mentors were really interested in the psychological kind of impact of mode on human emotion. And so that got me really thinking about like what role musical mode has in storytelling. And then Carrie kind of helped me illuminate that musically through some of his interests in music from the antiquity and like a very old music from ancient Greece and also his our shared interest in folk music. So we're going to be focusing heavily on mode through human history to kind of show the universality of human emotions, and then also all of the tools to tell those stories throughout history. So we'll be using very, very old instruments. We both have lyres, which is an old instrument from ancient Greece, and then we're even incorporating some electronic instrumentation into songs from ancient Greece and things like that. So it's that's kind of the arc that we'll be exploring in the program.
That's fantastic. I'm curious too how your collaboration with Carrie came about.
It was sort of fated. We both had a common mentor who's a soprano, an early music soprano, a very highly lauded early music soprano named Suzy LeBlanc, and she kind of put us together and suggested that we collaborate because of our shared interests in self-accompaniment, for one thing. We're both kind of Baroque musicians at heart, but we love playing instruments and singing while accompanying ourselves on instruments. And we were both artists who were kind of at the beginning of exploring, pushing the boundaries of the traditional sort of confines of early music. So other people who had observed that of us brought us together, and then we applied together to be part of this Banff artist residency, and that's kind of how it started. But the scene is really small in Montreal, so we both kind of already knew of each other, and I guess we were just kind of waiting for the right kind of fated moment for a collaboration.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely seems like the stars kind of aligned in that sense, and So in terms of as artistic collaborators, what do you enjoy the most about working with him?
Oh, that's a great question. I think we're both pretty tangential people. And so I like that there's a lot of space in our collaboration, to allow ideas to come through. Of course, we try and implement structure when we can, but there's also kind of big open spaces in our practice, and often it's in those kind of blank spaces that might feel losing time to other collaborators. It's often where our ideas materialize, kind of in that unknown. So I like that we can kind of both leave open kind of anticipatory space when we collaborate, and I really appreciate that we have very different skills as musicians. Carrie is an extremely talented instrumentalist. I'm more of a beginner. I know as much as I need to basically to accompany myself, but singing is my real instrument, and Carrie is a beautiful singer too, but I really appreciated leaning on his instrumental skills, especially. And our program also incorporates illustrations of mine that depict the different musical modes. So I was really happy to bring that aspect of my artistry in as well. So I think that together we have a really rich toolbox to create.
Yeah, I saw those the illustrations on the live stream, kind of displayed periodically during the performance. And I was curious, what was going through your mind when trying to represent these kind of, these esoteric things like musical modes? How does that come to life for you visually?
Oh, thank you for that question. I would say I have big artistic inspiration in a dear friend of mine and a Canadian artist named Meta Hepner-Hummy. And she has a lot of art online. And she also was a great mentor to me in terms of astrology and esoteric studies. So I learned a lot from her, and I derive a lot of inspiration from her artistic style. I guess I started with the modes, and I listened to music in those modes, and I read anything I could find online, any poetry or prose around those modes. And then I started to just kind of gather my own aesthetic sense of those modes based on what I'd read. then I would gather like imagery and start a layout, and then just kind of like let the pen guide me into creating those worlds. But it was a time, I've never made that much art in such a short period of time, and I'm sure some artists can relate. It just didn't even feel like I was doing it at a certain point. It was more like a, I don't know, some sort of divine inspiration. But that was the kind of the process. And also, we were trying to find out how we could kind of enrich this virtual experience since it was going to be online. And so the necessity became clear for more like imagerial elements of our program. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, as you say, it's like the needing to present it online versus in person. It's such a different, you know, kind of perspective on the performance. Is there like, will the visuals kind of be incorporated still in the in-person performance? Like, how has it changed since you're going to be like live in front of real people this time?
Yeah, I'm really hoping so. I think the way that we'll do it is with a projector screen behind us. So that's the idea. And of course, like, I don't know, I think it'll be a different experience for sure in person. And I'm hoping that the musical experience will take more of a sort of front seat in guiding the listener through the concert. And then I think in the way that the imagery was really, really important to the virtual experience, because it was kind of on the same plane. I'm not sure that it's possible to recreate with the resources we have for this concert, but I'm looking forward to at least like having it represented on a projector. And then all of that art is on my website. If listeners want to have like a more personal experience with the art afterwards, they can interact with it in that way as well.
Yeah, definitely. And you talked earlier about sort of divine inspiration, as it were, when you were creating art. And that kind of brings me to my question of, I have to ask, why the name Calliope, you know, from the Muses?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we were like, ancient Greece was sort of a big inspiration for the project in general. And yes, Calliope is one of the nine muses in Greek mythology, and she is the goddess of epic poetry and eloquence, which is a concept from the antiquity concerning like telling convincing and persuasive stories, often in the context of song or speech or poetry. So that kind of felt like a perfect mascot for our project. And it's just like, it's fun to say, Calliope. That helps as well. So that was kind of the creation story behind the name.
Yeah, it got a bit of a ring to it. Yeah.
And
so before we go, I just wanted to, you talked about this earlier as well, about your degree in music therapy. And I thought that was so interesting because it's a field that I don't see as many people talk about, but I know that it's like, I find it really fascinating. And I'm curious about how that has sort of informed your performance practice or like your relationship with music more generally.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, I would say I'm so glad that I started in music therapy as a study rather than performance, because I think the main thing that it did was put healing and connection as focal points in my artistic life rather than performance. And of course, like, now I think, yeah, healing and connection are the things that I try and embody and enact like through performance. But to me, like, that sense of like community building, of like finding a need in the community and responding to it with music, that really comes from music therapy for me. And it's also helped me be like a much more sensitive collaborator, I would say. I don't think we're often taught to like see, especially as singers and especially as classical singers, we're not always taught to make space, like to make the stage like a democracy or a necessarily collaborative space. some spaces definitely do that. But I think, yeah, sometimes in classical music, we miss that collaborative element in opera and things like that. So I'm really happy to bring that element for music therapy of like deep listening, even in performance, and like leaving space for spontaneity. And I think those elements also really lend themselves well to early music, where we have very little to work with in the score. There's really no, there's not a lot of like dynamic indication, or like a lot of it is up to us to interpret together, which involves being able to collaborate respectfully and with listening and creatively. So I think it's actually like a perfect marriage in that way. Yeah.
That's a beautiful perspective. Yeah, thank you so much. I think we're out of time, unfortunately, but thank you again for joining me today. It was very lovely speaking with you.
Thank you. Such a pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Well, we will return in a moment, and for now have some more music. This is Susie LeBlanc, Vincent Lozer, and Ellen Torrey. And this is Le Matou.
Avec vous, j'entends le coucou, mesdames qui prend garde à tout.
J'entends le coucou, mesdames qui prend garde à tout.
Tiroum, 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 j'ai entré dans sa chambre, je n'ai pris pas le cou.
J'ai entré dans sa chambre, je n'ai pris pas le cou.
Si votre mari arrive, vous me cacheriez-vous. J'entends le coucou, mesdames qui prend garde.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a dessous? Il dit à sa petite femme, qu'est-ce qu'il y a dessous?
Si
welcome back to Cadenza Montreal here on CJLO 1690. That was Ellen Torrey, Susie LeBlanc, and Vincent Lauzer off their album De la Cour de Louis Xavier. That was Le Mateau. That was great to speak with Ellen just now and hear her thoughts on the program. That will be, again, that'll be this Saturday, February 10th at Christchurch Cathedral. And it is free and at 2 p.m. So in the interest of time, you know, 1 hour is so somehow never enough for all the things that I want to do. But I actually have it's a 2-interview day. That hasn't happened in a while. And one was pre-recorded with Rebecca Bain. So keeping in the sort of early music theme of today's episode, we have Rebecca Bain, who's the artistic director of Ensemble Scholastica. So we'll learn more about that shortly. And so I will start playing our pre-recorded interview from the other day. Enjoy. Welcome back to Cadenza Montreal on CGLO 1690. I'm joined by Rebecca Bain, the artistic director of Ensemble Scholastica. The Women's Vocal Ensemble will be performing this Saturday, February 10th, at the Chapelle Notre-Dame de Bon Secours. Their program is called The Bride, the Dove, and the Rose, and features medieval music from women's communities across Europe. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the ensemble is named for Saint Scholastica, who founded an influential monastic order for women in the 6th century. And as it happens, I saw February 10th is actually Saint Scholastica's day. So does that make this concert feel... Yes!
I actually did not know that. I should. That's kind of fortuitous, because actually we were originally supposed to do this concert in November, and we had to postpone it at the last minute because there were a couple of cases of COVID, including myself, who came down with it just a couple of days before the concert.
Oh.
So it's actually, maybe Saint Scholastica is responsible somehow. Maybe she wanted us to do it on her day. Anyway, that's quite, thank you for looking that up. Yeah, Saint Scholastica, she founded the sister order to, her brother was Saint Benedict, who founded the very famous Benedictine order, very, very important, influential movement and institution during the Middle Ages. And she founded the sister order. And that's important for the history of music, because the Benedictines produced a lot of the earliest music, a lot of the earliest manuscripts containing musical notation came from Benedictine monasteries. And a lot of the work they did on developing notation, you know, was very important to the history of Western music.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad I brought that up then, because I figured as soon as I looked it up, I was like, well, I'm sure that's not a coincidence, you know, the date, it just all makes sense.
It actually was a coincidence, but now that you say it, I'm thinking maybe someone else, maybe Saint Scholastica herself had a hand in it.
Absolutely, yeah. And the music on this program, you know, it's really reaches across time and location. You're talking 12th to 16th mm-hmm. century, and Spain to
right.
Sweden, really all over Europe. So I'm curious about how these works kind of trace the evolution of this music over time and place.
Well, a lot of the, all the earliest musical notation that we have is, in terms of European music, is it's plain chant, because musical notation was developed so that, because monks and nuns were singing a lot during the day, and they kept adding new chants to the repertoire, to the liturgy, and they just couldn't remember it all. They had very good memories, much better memories than we have today. They worked on their memories, but you couldn't, and every day you would be singing something new, and often you'd have special chants for special occasions and so on, saints' days, and so you couldn't possibly remember it all. So the earliest notation they developed was to remember, so they could remember the plain chant that they were singing on any particular day of the year. And then from there it evolved, but the earliest notation you had to sort of know it already. It sort of jogged your memory, and then so they had to keep innovating developing things like the staff so that you could be more precise in the notation. And then as time went on, it got more and more precise. And polyphony was at the same time that polyphony was starting to be composed, they were developing techniques in order to notate polyphony. So, and all of this, we'll be singing examples of all of these things. And then we get into the late Middle Ages when, you know, now you have 3 and 4 voice pieces. And actually, we're going to go into the so-called Renaissance or the early modern period, because we do go into the 16th century. We'll be singing some works from Italian sources, from Italian convents in Florence, 16th century sources that are highly influenced by the earlier repertoires. And we do, it really is a kind of, the whole program kind of traces that whole evolution, as well as tracing the evolution of, you know, sort of women, of the women's monastic movements, which included, you know, lay monastic, lay orders, as they called them. So people who didn't take actual vows, but still lived in communities and sung, you know, devotional songs.
Yeah, for sure. And you were mentioning about, like, you know, later works having more and more voices. I saw that the concert would also be accompanied with a few period instruments, which is really interesting. How is that sort of comes around in the later eras? How typical was it for this kind of music?
I mean, it was typical. Instruments were used sparsely, and probably especially for liturgical music in churches. And as time went on, probably they used them more. But we know that instruments were used fairly early on. We don't know exactly what instruments played. A lot of instruments were developed to have sustained drones. Like some people might have heard of the hurdy-gurdy, and that's kind of a later development of an earlier instrument, which is played with a crank. That provides a sustained sound, which provides like a drone. Sorry, I could only think of the French word bourdon. It provides a drone for singers to sing against. So we have one of those instruments. We also have a medieval fiddle, which was one of the main instruments from the period, which was used in all repertoires, sacred and non-sacred music, all kinds of dancing music. And then we'll also have a flute, and we also have a psaltery, which is like a very early plucked instrument, not like a lute or guitar. It's quite a different instrument, and it was used, the name psaltery comes from the word psalter, which is a book that contains the psalms. So there is a direct connection to liturgical and sacred music there. And actually, We will use the instruments. These are really medieval instruments. These are not, weren't typically used during, like, in the later period, because by then instruments, they also had their own evolution, and they were starting to, the music instruments by that period were starting to resemble closer to what, modern classical instruments look like. So yes, we have the 4 instruments, and we are primarily a vocal ensemble, but some of us also play period instruments. I mean, a lot of people who do period music or especially medieval music do both singing and playing, would have been very common for people to accompany themselves in a very simple way. But as I said, the instrumental part of the equation was not notated, so we have some ideas about how they would do this accompaniment. Probably a lot of it was improvised or, semi-improvised.
Fascinating. Yeah. And you mentioned earlier how the instruments were, you know, these are medieval period instruments, which are a little like different than even later, like Renaissance and early music instruments as they went through their evolution. Exactly. And we were mentioning too about how, you know, medieval music in the genre of early music is still its own thing. Like, what do you think kind of most sets it apart and makes it special?
Well, the thing about medieval music, it's kind of a strange term to just to call it all of it medieval music and assume that it's all one style, because the medieval period was very long. It was like 1,000 years, and about one third of the way through is when we start seeing notated music and also paintings, depictions of people playing music. And so the medieval period for music represents, you know, six centuries or more, and different, you know, different areas of Europe, because usually when we talk about medieval music, we are talking about Europe, at least for this type of repertoire, sort of the pre-Western classical music. So many, many different repertoires, very, very diverse repertoires. And you not only have sacred music, you have, you know, secular music, or quite a few different repertoires of secular music. So it's very hard to say medieval music was such in such a way. But if I was to categorize it, if I was to distinguish it from later music, I would say it's more, it tends to be more on a smaller scale. Like there weren't orchestras during this period. Orchestral music is much later. And you have polyphony, but you don't really have more than four voices or four lines of music playing together until really until well into the Renaissance. So it's more intimate in that sense, and often you just have one line of music, monophonic music with accompaniment that you improvise. So that's one way to distinguish it. And also, of course, quite a hefty amount of it is sacred music, just because, as I said, the earliest music that we have notated comes from the monasteries, comes from the liturgical repertoires, because secular music wasn't notated as regularly as liturgical music was until the 13th, 14th century, yeah, starting with the troubadours in the 12th century. So, yeah. So, and that's what I love about it too. I love the intimacy, and I love all the detective work behind it, because we consult manuscripts a lot and make our own transcriptions very often and do a lot of research on the background, because it comes from a time, a very different time from our own, and very different culture, and also singing in languages that don't exist anymore, or medieval versions of languages that we speak today. So there's all of that as well.
Right, for sure. And as you said, I mean, the medieval period was so long, but still this music is in turn survived for centuries into, you know, being performed in the present day. How do you think like listeners and performers are like connecting with this emotionally still, you know, thousands of centuries later? How does that feel for you?
Well, people who come to our concerts for the first time, or other concerts that I might do with medieval music, and I've done concerts of medieval music in other parts of the world as well a lot. People who haven't heard it before, or who haven't heard it very much, are always surprised at how actually accessible it is. People have a lot of sort of stereotypical ideas about the medieval period in general, and know nothing about the music. You know, they can't even tell you, you know, what are the actual centuries during which the medieval period took place. I think people connect to it on a, you know, in the same way they connect to all music. It connects to our brain and our emotions in a way that's very direct. People are moved by music that has no lyrics. You know, it's the sound and the emotion that's created by the music itself. And this music, I think, first of all, it fascinates people because it was so long ago, and people love to learn about the history of music and to feel that connection to the past. I think that's really important. As performers, that's really powerful for us, to look at a manuscript and to try to recreate the sounds of the past. and people really connect to that. And also, I have to say, our specialty is singing. We're a women's vocal ensemble, so there's something about the woman's voice singing. We often sing in unison, so all of us singing the same line of music all together, and music that in languages that no one can understand. But people connect to the power of the woman's voice. This unified group of women singing the same thing at the same time. There's something very powerful about that that people often speak to us about. People who, again, often who know nothing about this repertoire, but they feel connected to that, the power of that.
Definitely. And yeah, it's like on the subject of like the, you know, the power of women's voice in this music, like the, you know, many medieval composers were anonymous, as the case with some of them on this program, but, you know, some women composers are named and will be performed here. And like, who are you most excited to feature?
I mean, I just, all of it is, I'm so keen always for people to discover these amazing gems of, you know, music. It's true that almost all the repertoire, especially the liturgical repertoire, was composed anonymously for various reasons. Certainly they didn't have quite the same notion of like authorship that we have today, and sort of ownership of artistic output and sort of things like that. And probably also it was frowned upon in the church to say that, you know, I composed this, rather than to say, oh, well, this came to me through an angel or whatever. You know, they had to say in order to remain humble, or for a woman, in order to not be considered suspect. So, I mean, really, always, I think people are really excited to hear the unison singing. But then, as you say, we do have, there are a couple of composers not very many, but named composers on our program, one of which is a nun who lived in the 16th century in Florence, who wrote this very passionate text that almost reads like a love poem. I mean, it does read like a love poem, with full of passion. But of course, it's a love poem to Jesus, or to and to her spiritual leader, and so on. But because there was a man called Savonarola who was a very influential sort of reformer in the church, so a love poem to him. But it could very well be a love poem to, you know, a modern love poem. That's very relatable to people, I think. I think all the music we're doing is music that's never, very, very rarely performed, even in Europe, where they do a lot more medieval music than we do. So I think it's going to be a discovery. It's for us as performers, it's always a discovery to sing new works, and new works that we've transcribed from the manuscript, knowing that, you know, the last time anyone sang this was maybe, you know, hundreds of years ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it will be exciting to hear that for sure. And thank you so much for joining me today, and best of wishes for the concert on St. Scholastica's Day.
Thank you. And thank you so much for letting me know about St. Scholastica's Day. Please come on Saturday at 7:30 in Old Montreal, and we hope you enjoy it.
Pansy, Annie, bonjour, hello. This is composer Andrew Balfour inviting you to experience Ispichiwin, a musical journey bridging cultures and perspectives. It is both a personal journey and evocative testament to the transformative power of music. This recording features Calgary's luminous voices with the incredible Jessica McMahon and Walter McDonald Whitebear on flutes. It is my hope that this album deepens our understanding of Indigenous storytelling. Ispichiwin is available now wherever you listen to music.
Welcome back to Cadenza Montreal here on CGLO 1690. Before the break there, that was my interview with Rebecca Bain, the artistic director of Ensemble Scholastica. And as she said there at the end, their concert is this Saturday, February 10th, St. Scholastica's Day, at the Chapelle Notre-Dame de Bon Secours at 7:30 p.m. That's in Old Montreal. So we are almost out of time here in the hour. It really just flew by today. But I will take a moment to play some two selections I think we'll have time for before the end, from Rebecca Bain and Ensemble Scholastica. They have two albums out. The first is their album Ars Elaboratio. This is a kind of compilation. There's a bunch of different Latin titles, but the first one on this is a Velux Impulit for this specific track. It's by an unknown composer. And also by an unknown composer is the Office for Saint Cri, Cathicola Religione, A Christo Quoquam. So I'll just play those back to back, and that should take us to the end of the hour. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's episode. Hope to see you in the next one. Enjoy the music and the rest of your day.